Hi, Bobby.
Hi, Marty.
Good to see you.
Good to see you.
That is the voice of Bobby Shore. Sitting alongside me is Justin Lovell, and we're sitting here talking to Bobby Shore, which I think is one of the most talented cinematographers that we have to date, not only in Canada, but worldwide. Bobby, I'm sorry to put you on a pedestal like that, but why don't you give the audience a taste of what you've done?
I kind of came up shooting comedies with Mike Douse. He took a chance on me and hired me to shoot a TV pilot, which turned into a TV series, which led to FUBAR 2, which led to Goon, which I guess kind of, legitimized my kind of role as like a DP from like a pretty young age. So I was pretty lucky there. And then after Goon, kind of started sliding towards television a little bit and did a season of Man Seeking Woman and then a bunch of like indie features just because I was trying desperately to shoot more dramatic content and trying to get more into music videos and more into kind of commercials. So started doing those in the last like 4 or 5 years. And then I just finished doing another TV show called Anne, which was great because it was a bit more on the dramatic side. And now I'm taking a bunch of time off.
The frustrating thing about you is that you do everything well that you set out to do.
See, I don't think so. I still feel like I have so much more to learn. And every day before I go to set, I'm usually kind of a bit of a nervous wreck. And I think I'm just going to fuck everything up.
The second thing that frustrates me about you is how humble you are and how you are a student of film. And even from the CC Instagram account that you took over,
yeah,
the knowledge that you just poured shows the type of person that you are. You've literally like poured your heart and soul into these Instagram posts, which for a lot of people are faff, but they were so beautiful. And
Awesome. I had so much fun doing that too. I just think having a platform to talk about your shit like that, where you don't have to just create the platform yourself, because I think I'm a way too of a self-conscious person to ever want to talk about myself like that. So it was kind of nice to just have an avenue to just spew all that kind of stuff out, which was awesome.
You're a very interesting shooter to me because you do these huge budget productions, but then you still embrace the low-end artistic side of cinematography. You still go after those short formats.
Yeah. Well, I think it's one of those things, like that notion that DIY or big budget doesn't really matter. I think it's just what you bring to the table from a sensibility standpoint that is going to have the most impact on the look and the feel of any project. Yeah, I've been super lucky working on like big budget stuff, which is great because you have the tools and the people surrounding you to, I think, pull off a lot of interesting stuff. But the projects I've been most proud of in the last 4 years or so are usually completely low budget projects where I have to pay out of pocket to like make sure that my crew is taken care of, or to make sure that production will pay overtime, or that we'll actually have a lighting kit, or I'll just call you and you'll give me shit because you're a good person. But honestly, it is one of those things. It's like, it's super, super important to not place so much stock in the scale of production, but place more importance on what the production means to you. So you can do the $500 music video or fashion film and be just as invested, or maybe sometimes more invested than the like $10 million feature. And again, I just think that is just kind of like a mindset. Being able to approach any project with that mindset ultimately instills it with a sense of importance, because there's been maybe a couple times on set where I've caught myself thinking, oh God, what am I doing here? Like, I'm too good for this. And as soon as I did that, I was like, what the fuck is wrong with me? It's like, it's such a privilege to be shooting anything. Yeah. And yeah, you want to strive towards shooting projects that I think really speak to you and where you feel a really strong emotional connection. And sometimes when you're shooting a commercial for garbage bags, it's kind of hard to remember that. But also, you know, that's, I think, what commercials can do best is subsidize kind of low budget art projects. You know, you just got to keep, I think, your sights open for all the good that can come out of all the projects that you can do.
So because of this myriad of work that you do, because you sort of cross-pollinate between commercials, music videos, indie short films, how do you adapt to the job?
I don't know. I don't. It's like I never really think about it. Honestly, you know what it is? And I've said this before. I think it's a pretty like apt descriptor of just my personality. I'm the youngest in my family. I have an older brother, older sister, older stepbrother, very dysfunctional family. Like, my parents got divorced when I was like 8 years old. My dad got remarried. So I think I learned from a very young age, and this is going to sound like completely sociopathic, but I learned from a young age kind of how to manipulate people to get what I wanted. Manipulate's not really the right word. I think it's like
guide.
Yeah, thank you. That's a much better euphemism. I just learned from an early age and just kind of never to take no for an answer. Not to be like this bratty, foot stomping, tantrum throwing toddler, but you can achieve so much through words and through dialogue and through good communication. So if you're doing a big budget project, that even if you're on a big budget project, there's never money for anything, you know, or if you're doing a low budget project where there actually is no money for anything, it's just about figuring out how you achieve a look and a feel. And there's a million of ways to do it. You just kind of have to be pretty determined. I completely forgot what the question was.
Jump out of here.
If you, are you going to come back in? And if you do, can I have another Pilsner?
You want? Why don't I just go to that right now?
Sure. Okay.
Or just at the...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Awesome. Thank you.
Yeah. Need something
else for me? No, I'm good.
Okay. This is fun. I actually legitimately forget what the question was, though.
How do you adapt?
Oh, yeah. That's a thing. You don't. I don't think you... No, but seriously, you don't. It's like, I think your mentality has to be the same for every fucking project you do. And I think once you start, I mean, yeah, you have to adapt. Like, yeah, you're not going to have like fucking like 12 grips to set this up. So you need to figure out a more, I guess, kind of like streamlined, simple approach. But I honestly think that your mindset should never adapt from project to project in terms of like, if you're there to achieve a specific look and a specific goal, and more importantly, a specific feeling, you have to do whatever you can do to make sure you achieve that and not let, you know, budget restraints or time restraints impact your ability to deliver something that in your head is the only way it can be. And I think I was kind of like mentioned that a little bit on like the Instagram. You're doing yourself and the project a disservice by not attacking or approaching every shoot kind of like that. Ultimately, once you've committed yourself to something, you can't half-ass it, you know, no matter what it is. If there's no money to properly pre-light something, go in and do it yourself. Get lights from your fucking crew and just go do it yourself. Or if there's not enough money, then it has to be supplanted with time. So just do more prep work. Go scout on your own. Talk to the director about shooting at the right time of day or something. I think there's always an answer. And what was interesting diving into the Netflix show Anne was, I think there was a certain mentality in television that it has to be done a certain way. I found it really interesting because it's like, I didn't approach it like a TV show. I approached it like a movie, and that was the mandate of the showrunner. You know, the conversations I would have with like the line producer and the PM sometimes, they were just kind of like, well, that's not how we do it in television. And I'm like, okay, but this isn't television. And even if that's not how you do it, this is kind of how I think it would best serve the project and the story. So I know there's no money for this, but what if we did this? Or what if we did this? Or I'm just going to go scout there on my own on a Saturday because I want to make sure that the AD knows how to schedule the day properly. And those conversations were always met with kind of weird blank stares and a bit frustratingly, a lot of condescension, because I think I was looked at as a young kid who didn't know how to shoot television. I guess this is also, I think I'm a pretty sensitive person. So I think when I feel like I can't have a very open and honest dialogue with someone, it tends to really kind of sit in my gut a lot, you know, in terms of like, I start to get nervous, I start to get anxious and all that stuff. And so a lot of the dialogue was a little bit difficult with kind of like the production side sometimes, you know, but ultimately going back to what I was saying before was, no matter how awkward or weird, or I guess kind of condescending I felt they were to me, I was just kind of like, oh, fuck it. I'm just going to try to figure out a way to do this anyways. And just, you know, you have the support of the showrunner, you have the support of the crew, and you have the support of the actors and stuff. So
I guess on that kind of big machine, obviously on any level, discourse is important.
Yeah.
How would you qualify if there's a director involved? Can't they go to bat for you? Can't they help you out?
Well, that's the thing that I found. Well, I don't know. This is like the most consistent aspect of my job, from the multi-million dollar features to the $500 music video. The thing that I always find is, I kind of feel that part of your role as the DP is the conduit between the director and production. Because the director can be like, I need this many extras, I need this or whatever. But if you're shot listing and you're like, oh man, yeah, that'd be great. Like crane shot here, or you know what, let's like put a mirror behind our main actor so that we don't need to do a turnaround. We can just rack focus and see our other actor kind of like behind him. So then you go to the art department and then you go to the production manager and they're like, well, we didn't have a budget for a mirror, so what are we gonna do? Do you know what I mean? But I think that that's part of the DP's responsibility. sometimes, because I think directors have so much more shit to think about just in terms of story and acting, that when you get together, you shot list, you just make a bunch of notes, and then you're like, okay, I need to talk to this person, and this person. You just tell the director, don't worry, I got it. It was interesting on Anne, though, because that was like, you know, one of the earlier discussions I had with the line producer on Anne was...
Pause.
Oh, perfect.
When you say Pilsner, I don't drink, so
I'll... It says Pilsner on it.
Yeah.
Where?
Right,
These are
right there.
Oh, I see.
Kind of tastes like coffee. Oh, what were we talking about?
So...
I remember what it was. In prep, during Anne, we went to PEI and shot, and... The director was a woman named Nikki Caro, who has done phenomenal fucking work and whose films I'd been watching since I was in film school. So when I got hired to work on the show, knowing she was the pilot director, A, I immediately thought, don't fuck this up. B, I thought, I'm going to fuck this up. And then C, I told her, I think I'm going to fuck this up, which was hilarious because she'd never heard of imposter syndrome before. And so we were like on a weekend, we were just like driving out to like our Green Gables set. And I she's worked with like fucking like Adam Arkapaw and like Chris Menges and just people that are just at another fucking level. And so I started to tell her what imposter syndrome was. She was like, oh, I've never heard of that before. And I was like, yeah. So it's basically when you feel like a complete fraud and that everyone's going to discover you're a complete fraud and then you're going to get fired and never work again. Anyway, so we were shooting in PEI. During prep, our first AD was trying to help us kind of like schedule the day. And there was a scene we wanted to shoot at a specific location that kind of really only worked at a specific time of day. And for it to look the best, I told the AD, well, it should be done between this time and this time. And unfortunately, that kind of meant from a logistics standpoint, having to kind of like shuttle around a couple different locations. So logistically, it made the shoot a little bit less convenient, but look-wise, it just kind of just made sense. And so I mentioned that to the AD. And the reason why I mentioned to the AD was because the director turned to me and said, hey, Bobby, when's going to be the best time of day to shoot this? And I was like, well, if we're going to use this location between this time and this time, but if we can't make that work for the schedule, then we should try to find a different location to shoot. And the AD basically passed that on to the line producer, because when we were shooting in PEI, we were supposed to shoot like a day of like B-roll, and it turned into 3 days of 10 pages of dialogue scenes, 2 days of helicopter work, 3 days of Russian arm work. And this was all because the pilot director was like, you need to establish PEI in the pilot episode. You can't just shoot like a fucking seagull like flying around like a cliff or whatever. And so when the AD passed on this information to the line producer, he put it in the context of, yeah, well, our schedule for this day is going to get a little bit fucked with because Bobby says we have to shoot at this time. And I get a call from her and she's like, I don't want you talking to the director about the right time of day to shoot. I need you to be talking to me about this. Like, you need to remember that in television, the DP is there to work with production, not with the director. And I was kind of like, okay, that's interesting. Like my role as a DP, I think, is kind of to be the director's right-hand person. And I'm not used to, like, obviously you're beholden to production and you should be responsible to production and you should do everything in your power to make everything work so that everyone is happy. But ultimately, you want to do what's best for the show. You want to do what's best for the director's vision. And so I was just kind of like, that really set an interesting tone for me for the next 6 months, because it kept on coming back. Every episode was a different director. And at first I was kind of scared about that. I was like, oh, what's it going to be like? This person's going to want to come in. And what if they want to do something different? And I was talking to other friends of mine who shot television. And they were like, you know, it's your job as the DP. You're the gatekeeper of the image. You got to protect the look of the show. And if most of the pilot was shot on dolly or sticks, you can't just do a lot of Steadicam all of a sudden. And the second director, Helen Shaver, who did episode 2, wanted to use Steadicam all the time. And she was fucking phenomenal. She was such a good director. She just worked from the gut, worked from the heart. She just knew how she wanted things to feel. And at first I was super reticent to be like, well, we can't put it on Steadicam. We only used it twice in the pilot. Like, this is how we do it. And then I was kind of like, wait, why? You know, this thing that's great about a television show is like the look gets to evolve. You're not just developing the look in an hour and a half. You get to do it over 7 hours or 8 hours or 9 hours. Right. And I started, instead of fighting the idea that maybe a director wanted to do something differently, I tried to just embrace it, as long as it wasn't, you know, crazy, like super outside of like the realm of what we had done on the pilot. And it just became this really nice, liberating approach. And to take it back to what the original topic of conversation was with the relationship with production and the line producer, and what you said about being kind of like, you know, that kind of conduit between the director and production, what I started to find was, you know, my sensibility coming from features will always be I'm there for the director, and in television, there for the showrunner. So every weekend I was prepping the episodes as I was shooting. So I basically was working 7 days a week. So we'd shoot 5 days a week. And then on the Saturday, I would prep with the director I was currently shooting with. And then on the Sunday, I would prep with the director that was starting the next episode. And so every weekend, I would just like send a barrage of emails to the PM being like, here's what we spoke about. Here's what we're looking for. We want to get this, 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 and this. And I started to realize how much fun it was to be that kind of conduit. Do you know what I mean? And to work with the director that closely. And it's just like, it's such a collaborative fucking medium. And coming from features, I just feel a sense of, I guess, I don't know what the right word is. I just like, I don't want to say like beholden to the director, but I want to work for them. Do you know what I mean? Especially when they're good people. And there were so many good directors on this show that all of my fears became assuaged so quickly. And then I just started to realize that, yeah, no, I should be working with them and working for the good of the show, and that you can do that and still, I think, be responsible to production.
You've qualified yourself before that you're not a technical person. But on a show like Anne, where you're doing multiple cameras, you have multiple toys, how do you approach shows like that?
I don't know, man. I mean, here's the question. Like, how do you define a technical DP? Do you know what I mean? It's like, I mean, I know how you define it. Like, you think of someone like David Stump or something that was like, I remember just reading like books that he's written where it's like this, you know, digital CMOS pixel stuff. I'm just like, what the fuck? I just don't know. So for me, that's kind of like a technical DP. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I guess like understanding all that stuff. And I guess, you know, like for a show like Anne, it's like, yeah, you have to run a bunch of cameras. You have to know how shit works. But I guess that doesn't seem super technical. Maybe, I don't know.
But for example, like there's a myriad of lenses out there. There's camera movement, especially. Like there
is that. I guess I never looked at that as technical, though. When I think of technical, I'm like, okay, we should shoot Arri Raw because the client wants to do a center extraction from an anamorphic lens. So we need to make sure we have the resolution and blah, color space and blah, blah, blah. What dolly you use or what crane you use to achieve a shot is like, yeah, that's obviously there's a technical side because it's inherently technique, but I guess I just almost look at that as more just kind of like experience. Oh, I've done this before and it worked well, or I did it before and it fucking sucked, so I'm gonna try doing it a different way now. And
but like lenses, for example, like you have an obsession with like Panavision lenses.
Yeah, I think just anything old just feels better to me, obviously given the right project.
That key word that comes out is what feels better.
Mm-hmm.
And from my understanding of the way that you work, it's more about feel and about texture and about tone. You talk about a lens and you can say, I like the look of this lens. You look at it and aesthetically, you're like, that's it. That's my look.
Yeah.
Do you spend a lot of time on the technical side, like number crunching?
No, definitely not. No, it's like lens testing for me is basically putting the oldest, shittiest lens I can on a camera, put a face in front of it, a bunch of lights, something that'll flare the lens so you see how badly it flares with a direct light source, with a veiling light source, and then testing that against other lenses so that you can see how good or how bad the resolution is. And what was interesting with Anne was like, we tested more than 70 prime lenses and just handpicked our A set and B set. And then some of the just weirder ones that were too kind of like fucked up to actually use on the show, we just kind of kept like on the A camera cart. And we're like, oh, this is a cool lens. Let's just, you know, it flares really weird. Let's just put it on for this one specific shot. Cause wherever the character is at emotionally, like that weird rainbow flare over the face will be perfect. But you can't do that for every single scene. Cause then people will be like, what the fuck? And that was actually hilarious, man. Cause there were times, and this was where Nikki was, I think, probably one of the best directors I've worked with. Cause she was so creatively supportive of everything that we wanted to do on the show. So using these really old lenses, you know, a lot of our night scenes were literally just candlelight, and we had a 50 mil that opened to a T1, and we would just put neg fill over the entire set and put a bunch of candles and shoot at T1. And what happens is like, you get all sorts of weird chromatic aberrations around people's faces and stuff. And normally you'd have a director that would be like, what is that? Like, it doesn't look clean enough. And she was like, no, give me more. Like, this is great. It was like, it was just awesome. And I think that's it, is like to work with people that are supportive of what you want to do and that will let you kind of go there. And the showrunner Moira was exactly like that as well. She was just like, yeah, man, like you do your thing. She's like, I like the way it's looking. I like the way it's feeling. So just keep doing it. That's fucking worth its weight in gold, you know, because it just, I think it inspires you to push things further. It inspires you to see what other avenues and directions you can like take a look. And I think it creates this space where you're not scared to fuck up. And it also creates a space where if you do fuck up, you can at least turn to the person and say, hey, I thought this would work and it didn't. And I apologize. Let's try it differently next time. And 9 times out of 10, they'll be like, cool, at least you tried. And again, that was like not to keep bringing it back to production, but I did have a very interesting relationship with the production on this show. I had that with the showrunner. Like I'm talking about a very kind, supportive relationship. I had it with Nikki. I had it with basically every director that came in and every department, the ADs and everyone. But just between production manager and the line producer, it always just felt like there was like a disconnect and it didn't even feel like we were on the same team. It's like normally you need something, even if there's no budget, people tend to kind of work together to figure it out. And it just never really felt like that. And after months and months and months, it was kind of like of being told, no, you don't need that. No, you don't know what you're doing. No, you're not allowed to do this. Like basically telling me, you know, what gear I could bring to a location because they thought it would take too long to set up. And it was just kind of like, oh man. Then you start to believe it after a while. And you're like, oh fuck, maybe I don't know what I'm doing. Maybe I don't know how to shoot television because I'm asking for a dolly for this shot. It was a very weird, super supportive on one hand, and then like really kind of the opposite on the other, you know? So
how do you feel you came out at the end? Where did you fall in that show? More supported, less supported, like middle row? Like
I don't know. I think from the people that mattered, supported. But the EP, who's the reason why I got the job, decided after we had already set the look for the pilot and the second episode, after the show was done and I was like in Europe, like fucking working or whatever, she just decided she hated the way it looked and started cranking everything up. So halfway through the third episode, the look of the show just completely changes. And it was like obviously frustrating. You know, the colorist calls me and I've worked with him before. He's an amazing guy, has a really, really fantastic eye and a good kind of like aesthetic sensibility. And he was just like, I'm sorry, I couldn't do anything. I basically was told, I don't want your input. Do what I'm telling you to do and just make everything brighter. And he was trying so hard to kind of like maintain the integrity of the look. And unfortunately, 7 months after we had a discussion of what the look of the show would be and put all this creative time, energy, and effort into really carefully crafting this look, it just gets completely fucked with.
Who was the colorist?
Jim Fleming from Technicolor, who I can't speak fucking highly enough of. Again, this just goes back to like working with people who give a shit and working with people who really care. After this happened, I got 4 phone calls from him just profusely apologizing and being like, I'm so sorry. I tried my best to stand up for the look of the show and I just got completely steamrolled. Like, I hope you don't hate me. And I was like, listen, mate, it's completely out of your hands, man. I know what you were up against and there's nothing you could do. And I appreciate the sentiment, but you know, you don't need to be so apologetic about it. Kind of back to your question about leaving the show feeling more supported or less supported, it kind of left me with a bit of a sour taste in my mouth, to be honest. So
what, shout out Jim.
Yeah, Jim.
Yeah, one time.
Shout yeah, Jim definitely. One time. Jim, I'm pouring my traditional English style brown ale all over the carpet of this studio for you right now.
What about from the lighting side of things, working with a gaffer, are you the kind of person who likes to say, you know, I like this light, the technical side of the lighting?
Yeah, no, that side. Well, so this is the thing that's really interesting to me is I honestly think that's a really awesome question too, because I think that the importance of the collaboration between the DP, the gaffer, and the key grip is something that it's always mentioned. It's always, I can't give enough thanks to my key grip for doing this or my gaffer for kind of like supporting me through this. But for me, it really is one of those things that it's like you have an idea of what you want something to look like and to feel like, and you have an idea of how you want to achieve it. And the way I come to any sort of, say, like setup is kind of like what you said, where it's like I have a very, very specific idea of what lights I want to use, what diffusion I want to use, how things should be hung, how things should whatever, you know. But ultimately, I think that having that conversation with a gaffer and key grip is going to develop a new idea, like a new vision of how it would be done. And ultimately, I think that new idea will be the better idea. Like, I never kind of worked in the camera department. I don't think I had the kind of mental capacity to work in that type of detail. So I always, before I was like shooting consistently, was either gaffing or besting and just kind of coming up through like lighting. And so from that side, I feel extraordinarily comfortable from like a technical standpoint, not in terms of like, if I had to run power for someone, I'd probably electrocute myself, but in terms of knowing what a lamp can do and what you can do to that lamp to achieve certain thing. I love that part so much. Like, I love the idea of like, you put up one light in the right place with the right shit in front of it, and you literally, that's all you need to light an entire scene, no matter where the camera's looking, if you talk to the director and block stuff properly. I love the simplicity with which you can do stuff. And I love, like, and this is actually really funny, like, back to the Anne stuff again. I know we keep talking about it, but obviously it's kind of still fresh in my mind. There would be these times on set where, you know, you have this army of people behind you waiting to do stuff and truckloads of fucking gear, and anything you want to do, you could basically kind of like achieve it. And then there'd be times where it'd be like me and the director off in the corner with our main actor and just the first AC and a candle, and then like all this other shit just behind us for like a half an hour. The production manager's looking at her watching, what the fuck are they doing? Like, why are they over there shooting next to a candle when there's all this stuff here? It was hilarious, man. It was really like, it was funny.
It's interesting to note every DP has a different kind of thing that they're really good at.
Yeah. Like, I think mine's enthusiasm.
I'm great at enthusiasm.
Yeah, I'm really good at enthusiasm. It's awesome. I got lucky. I figured out what I wanted to do like from a really young age. When I was like, you know, 18 and saw Darren Aronofsky's Pi, I was like, holy shit, I haven't been made to feel like this from a movie in like ever. Do you know what I mean? I saw it right before going to film school. And so when I went to film school, it was like, we were shooting a bunch of fucking black and white reversal, which I had read about for like Pi. So I was like, okay, cool, man. Let's like rip off the look of Pi. And obviously it was a horrific car crash of a failure. But I just kind of like, because of that, I just kind of like naturally gravitated towards wanting to like be behind the camera and shoot film and see what happened when you moved a light from here to here. And so that was just kind of a very natural progression. And obviously because of that, I tracked Darren Aronofsky's career and Maddie Labatique's career. And then Maddie Labatique shot this movie called Abandon in Montreal when I was like 20 years old. It was like right after Requiem for a Dream came out. And I signed up to do extra work on it so I could just hang out on set and watch him light. And it was fucking awesome. So I was seeing this like guy that for me was like a hero, just like walking around set. And you could always tell when he was stressed out because he had an unlit cigarette in his mouth. He would just walk around like kind of fake smoke it. And I was just like, oh my God, that's so fucking cool. I want to do that. Anyway, so yeah, I signed up to do like background work on it. And then one day I go to a bar that a friend of mine had like a DJ night at, and the entire camera crew from Abandon is there, Maddie Labatique being one of them, and kind of build up the courage to go talk to him and introduce myself and let him know how much I like his work and how big a fan of his I am. And I kind of asked him what he did, how he got into shooting, and he mentioned American Film Institute. And so as soon as he said American Film Institute, I'm like, okay, well, that's what I got to do because Maddie Labatique did it. So yeah, I was like 20 or 21 at this point. And then 3 years later, I was at AFI. And while I was at AFI is when I started to really learn a lot about lighting because of all the other people in the cinematography department, so many various backgrounds. And there was one student in particular, this guy named Chad Colomia, who worked as like a spark on Roger Deakins movies. You know, like Roger Deakins wrote one of his letters of reference to get into AFI. And he just schooled the fuck out of me when it came to lighting. I didn't know anything. And I would just be on set. And he was actually one of the best teachers I had there, just like, who was like basically kind of like a fellow student, because he loved imparting this knowledge. And so I didn't know what I was doing at all. And he would just be like, oh, you can do this. And there's this type of diffusion and this and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, wow, this is amazing. It set a very, very strong foundation for, I think, having a strong appreciation for what you can do lighting wise to make things look and feel a certain way.
I want to talk about the other half.
Oh, yeah.
Because Tatiana Maslany gave you a shout out.
I heard about that, man. Wait, were you there?
I was.
Okay, what did she say? Did she just say?
She said shout out one time, Bobby Shore.
No,
did she? More eloquently. Like, she was, I mean, people who know you automatically fall in love with you. But I want to contrast the other half and what that was against Anne.
Yeah.
And did you do that before? Or
after? Yeah, I did that summer before. That was, okay, so the other half, I think for me, was hands down the best experience I've ever had shooting anything. It was one of my best friends who wrote and directed the movie. He'd been trying to get it made for 8 years. I'd been talking to him about it for 8 years. And finally, after 8 years, he got $1 million and Tatiana Maslany and her boyfriend, Tom Cullen, to come into Toronto and be shot for 16 days. And so for me, that is the epitome of a kind, supportive, collaborative environment. And that stems to everyone on the shoot. Not only the director, which I think kind of like really sets the tone, because I think everything kind of rolls downhill from there, but I've never felt a greater sense of trust from the actors as well. It was such a privilege to have them bring me into their fold. We would start every day with a private blocking, and it'd be me, Joey, you know, Tom and Tat, and we would just sit there and quietly read the lines, and Joey would be like, turn to me and be like, so what do you think? And I'd be like, well, we can do this, this, and this. Then the actors would be like, so Bobby, what do you think? And so, you know what I mean? So it became this thing of like, it was such a good back and forth. And it was, I think for me, the epitome of how filmmaking at its best should be. It was such an amazing experience. And I think visually also, it was nice to be able to shoot a very dark, emotionally driven, character driven drama. And it was really nice to work with a director that was open to kind of like taking chances and shooting a lot of scenes in oneers or not getting a lot of coverage. Or the whole premise of how we approached it was all based on feeling. We shot listed the movie 3 times before we actually went to camera, but the shot listing wasn't this shot, this shot, this shot. It was this feeling, this feeling, this feeling, so that there would be times where we would block a scene that was supposed to take place in a kitchen at night. And then we realized in the location we were at, there was a piano in the living room and Tom happened to play piano. And it was just one of those things where he was like, oh, what if we tried it over there? Even though the grips were building tents in the kitchen so we could do day for night. And I was just kind of like, yeah, give me 1 second. I was like, hey, TJ, who's like the key. I was like, hey, TJ, just stop what you're doing. We're just going to figure some shit out. And he was like, hey, cool. You know, and then we went to the living room and then Tom sits at the piano and Tatiana comes and sits next to him. And none of this is scripted. He just starts playing the piano and they talk. And it's like, for me, it's like one of the most beautiful scenes in the movie, because we gave ourselves the time and we gave ourselves, I think, the permission to find that stuff. From a lighting standpoint, I was like, hey, Joey, can we just like turn this lamp on and just do it with that? And he's like, yeah, that's fine. I don't give a fuck. He's like, if it's dark, I don't care. Like, it should be, you know? And so it was just like, it was just one of those things. So it didn't matter what happened to the scene, where it went, if it became a day scene or a night scene, you just know the script and the story and the characters so well that you can just figure it out. Again, that's a testament to doing the work in prep, to let go of technique and let go of all the shit that you need to get that story on the screen and just figure out how to do it in the way that best serves the story and kind of serves character, which was awesome. I also want to see the video of Tat giving me a shout out because I never saw it.
Try to find it.
There's probably going to be some people listening to this who are starting out, or there's successful DPs who are still doing what you're doing as well. To get to where you are now, did you do a lot of your own passion projects? Some people would say they would shoot cars because they know they want to get car work. Yeah. And that's going to get their foot in the door with that kind of work to build a career.
Yeah.
Did you forego all that and just do your own thing?
I kind of got into things a little bit ass backwards, where it's like generally you start doing music videos, then commercials, and then features in television. Or while you're doing the commercials and music videos, you do a low budget feature or low budget long form, whatever. But just by virtue of the way I guess by virtue of the way fucking nepotism works, was when I was like 26 and still at film school, I had a director friend in Montreal whose regular DP couldn't shoot a comedy series for IFC. And I left school for 2 months to go back to Montreal to shoot this comedy series. And he basically just took a chance on me. And after I had that one credit under my belt, all of a sudden Douse was like, oh, well, you have that one credit. So, you know, I just worked with a big DP in the States who worked really slowly. And now I want to work with someone young who will basically shoot when I tell him I'm ready to shoot and will not have me wait 40 minutes on lighting. So I'm going to hire you to do this pilot. And so I kind of actually started more on the narrative route. I didn't start shooting commercials till like 5-6 years ago. And I think I'd shot up until 6 years ago, I'd shot more features than commercials. And so it was actually interesting. It was like a little bit kind of like limiting, because it's like, I would shoot something like FUBAR 2, which I mean, whatever, it's like not a fucking visual movie, but it was, you know, it had a budget and was like, did well in Canada and all that stuff. Or maybe a better example is like, I would shoot something like Goon, which was a bigger budget and seen in the States and kind of seen all over the place. And then I'd kind of go back to my apartment in Montreal and just kind of sit there and like twiddle my thumbs. And like, I couldn't fucking get a job after that. It would be like months of like, wow, God, how come I can't get a job? Like, no one would call me for commercials because I wasn't a commercial DP, and no one was calling me for music videos because I hadn't really shot that many music videos at that point. So, you know, you come off a $12 million feature that's like theatrical distribution in like the States and Canada and like plays TIFF and all this stuff. And I was still felt like this unknown kid that hadn't done shit, which was like really interesting. So then I think what happened after that was I was kind of just taking any projects that came to me because I was like, I want to work. I don't want to sit around for months and not do anything. And then realized that I was taking on projects that didn't necessarily speak to me in the way that I wanted them to. I felt like I was just saying yes because it was an option. I wasn't saying yes because it was something that I actually wanted to do. And so then I got really, really lucky with, there's this directing duo called the Pelorian Brothers that do commercials. And I didn't know anything about commercials at the time because I barely knew how to use Vimeo or whatever. But like, but these guys were like not only big in Canada, but like pretty big in the States. And they had a job and they're like, yeah, we don't want to use the typical commercial DPs in Toronto. And this is when I was still living in Montreal. And so they ended up getting in touch with my agent who repped more narrative people, and they saw my reel and they was like, oh, let's try this guy. And if he fucks it up, we'll never work with him again. And it went well enough that I've shot probably like 30 or 40 spots with them at this point. And it was so liberating because I was like coming to Toronto to start shooting commercials. I felt like such a fish out of water, but people here were so welcoming and so warm and just so like, yes, come join us and be happy and be merry. And I was just like, this is fucking great, man. Cause like, I never really felt that too much in Montreal, you know, it's a very insular setup. At least it was for me. It was a really nice change of pace. And then that also, again, all of a sudden I was a commercial DP now because I had shot one spot with these directors that had a good reputation. And then that just kind of snowballed into more and more stuff. And then did some music videos and then more commercials and then moved to Toronto, which was the best thing I could have fucking done. I wish I did it earlier. And then everything's just been kind of like great since then, because I think what commercials allow you to do is be a little bit choosier about what long form projects you want to do, just because, again, it can subsidize working on your best friend's $1 million indie for free for 3 weeks. And I would have paid out of pocket to work on that movie with Joey and Tom and Tad. Like, no question. That for me seems to be the benchmark for how you choose to approach a project. When you've done these in the past, I know you did kind of like Stuart Campbell and Ben yesterday, right?
Bob Gundew.
Is it generally just kind of like a free form, kind of like let's chat and
some direction on things that like talking to you so people understand who you are? And then also the fact that it's inspirational to be able to hear what you did to get from where you were to where you are now.
I guess that's it. I just always assume that whatever I'm saying is just kind of like boring. Do you know what I mean?
Not in the least, no.
No.
It's really interesting too, because when I talked to Bob, he's a super technical guy.
Yeah.
Actually, he worked at IMAX. He like helped develop Maya, like crazy stuff. Like, it's all very, very technical.
Yeah.
And then with Stuart, he was very much idea driven because he came from a creative agency. And then, like, for yourself, I was trying to find out where it was that you initially started. You talked about how you got into lighting, and AFI was a huge influence on you. But even if you went back further than that, as a kid, did you have, like, visual things that, like, cued you?
Well,
yeah, like, filmmakers. Like, give us, like, I'm sure.
Well, no, that's the thing is, it's like, I didn't understand what fucking filmmaking was until I was interested in it. But it's like, so when I was a kid, going way back, 3 years old, 4 years old, every time my parents took me to the movie theater and the movie ended, I would start bawling because I hated the fact that like this spectacle, this presentation was over. And then my parents took me to go see The Neverending Story in theaters, and I had a fucking meltdown. I was just like, because I thought, I legitimately, because I was such a stupid kid, I actually thought the movie wouldn't end. There wasn't like, I didn't grow up in a kind of like a household that was very driven by film or television. Like, you know, my mom's a musician, so obviously there was an artistic presence in my household. My dad was like a biochemist scientist, so he was super analytical and rational, which I think made for a pretty interesting, I guess, kind of like dichotomy in parenting approaches or whatever. Actually, I guess the one thing my dad did which was really interesting was, when I was a kid, we couldn't afford a VHS player because it was too expensive. It cost like $600 to get like a VHS player when I was like 4 or 3 or whatever. So on special occasions, I'd go to the video store with my dad and he'd rent a VCR. Which came in like this massive gray Pelican case where I think they had to fucking handcuff it to your wrist to make sure no one stole it from you. And we would rent movies on like Saturday nights, like once a month or something. You know what? I guess maybe that instilled a certain, I guess, sense of, I don't know, kind of like privilege with watching films or something. You know, when I was like a teenager, it's like, yeah, I'd go see movies downtown, but it was more an excuse to like go downtown and like smoke cigarettes in public. It wasn't like I'm going to the movies, and there was like austere, mystical quality of it. That only started once I actually started studying film. It was like this weird thing of, there wasn't an inherent interest that drove me to study film. I didn't know what the fuck I wanted to do. I was studying commerce when I was at CGEP when I was 18 years old because I was good at math and I didn't understand what I really wanted to do with my life. And all my friends were doing liberal arts degrees and making movies. And I had no interest in really making movies, but I kind of saw how much fun they were having doing it. And so when they all applied to communications at Concordia, I was like, well, I want to go to school with my friends, so I'm going to apply to communications also. But then it just so happened that around that same time is when I saw Pi and was like, holy shit, film can make you feel a certain way. Once that happened, it was just like this trigger, this thing that I was like, oh my God, this is what I want to do. This is so, I felt like, I think, a sense of passion for the first time since I started, I guess, like skateboarding. That was like the previous thing I was passionate about or whatever. And then when I was in film school, there's a repertory cinema in Montreal called Cinéma du Parc. And I went to go see Lynn Ramsey's Morvern Collar when I was like 20. And that just fucking blew my mind. And so as soon as I saw that movie, I was like, I didn't know movies could be made like this. This is crazy. And then just like dove into like European art house stuff and the Dog Me guys and then Paul Thomas Anderson and Martin Scorsese and just all that shit. And it was just kind of all downhill from there.
What do you have coming up next that you're interested in?
I have no idea. I'm taking time off. I'm trying to.
Why?
Because I think that work is actually overrated. And I think it's really important to make time for your family and your friends and, more importantly, yourself. This also coming from someone who's single and whose family is in Montreal and who has no responsibilities outside of the 3 bicycles I own. But you know what I mean? I think that, as the two of you clearly know, because you fucking shoot as well, you get involved in a project, especially something long form, and it is all consuming, man. It's like that shit just owns you. And so I think I've realized in the last couple of years, especially because, you know, my dad's gone through some like health issues. And I'm 37 years old and haven't had a real relationship in like 6 years or whatever. You kind of get to a point where I think, as all consuming as this work is and as passionate as you feel about it, I think you need to have a balance and figure out how to take the aspects of your life outside of work and make that just as important, because I think ultimately that will inform the work itself and then your work will get better. Unless that's just an excuse to take time off and drink.
Right, no, now. I agree with that. Yeah. I agree with that.
It's been an interesting last 6 months since Anne finished, because I've just been turning down a bunch of stuff that just for me just doesn't seem interesting, like features and TV shows, even like commercials where I'm like, you know what? I would rather sit in the park and read a book than go be in a studio all day. But which again, I think comes from the privilege of being single and not having a family to support and just having to take care of my 3 bicycles. So it's like,
what is something that you'd like to do next?
Basically anything like the other half, something that's just so character and story driven. And obviously I think something that's like visual, but again, even the idea of something visual is completely subjective. I think you can stand back and watch the other half and be like, well, it's not really a visual movie. You think of like a visual movie, you're like, oh, fucking like 2001 or sci-fi or a period piece or something, because it's inherently visual. But for me, what makes something inherently visual is how you bring the story to the surface through the way you use the camera and lighting and stuff like that. So yeah, I think anything like that on the narrative side. I just love music videos. I just want to shoot fucking cool music videos with cool people. And not cool because it's cool, but like, you know what I'm talking about, like fun stuff, like the kind of shit that like Chase Irvin's doing or like Evan Prosofsky or those dudes.
Well, what was the one that I loved that you did that I think you should have won for, but you won for the other one?
Oh, the Majid Jordan one?
Not Majid, no. It was very soft. It was very beautiful. And it was just the story of two ladies like...
Oh, yeah. What was it called? Power Lines, I think.
Power Lines. You won for Power Lines and I wanted you to win for...
Oh, yeah. The Thugly one. That video sucked.
But that's, I don't know, every composition in that music video was stunning.
Yeah, but it was just boring. It's just a bunch of people standing around not doing anything. Oh, do you know what I mean? And I think that's the thing, is like you can have that, and that's what I find so interesting about...
Everybody should go watch that right now. Power Lines and Thugly, and make your own...
Yeah, make your own call. Make your own call. But here's the thing that I find so interesting about working with different directors is... You can literally have a director that will come up with a concept of people just standing around, not doing anything. But for some reason, there's this intangible quality of how it's interesting. And then a different director will have a similar concept, but it just won't feel engaging at all.
But I think the power of that video for me is the composition is so bold and I really feel your influence in those frame decisions. Am I wrong?
Like, no, I hope so. I mean... I don't know. I mean, what's your take on that idea of like feeling like the hand of like a DP on a project? I think from a narrative standpoint, you shouldn't, which is weird to say. It's like a Chris Doyle movie will feel like a fucking Chris Doyle movie, but in a different way than a Bob Richardson film will feel like a Bob.
Richardson's got that highlight.
Well, he's just, every one of his movies kind of feels the same way. Like, he has a very specific approach to lighting and lensing, and I think it works great. But Chris Doyle is like, yes, all of his work with Wong Kar-wai feels a very specific way. But once he started kind of working on American movies, I think he brought that sensibility, but it felt different. And so I think, yeah, when a Chris Doyle movie feels like a Chris Doyle movie, but I think you're feeling the sensibility of like the person behind the camera, not the sensibility of the technique that person uses. Right. And I think there's a pretty big difference there. And I think a notable difference.
That video I just loved because I just felt that you had the freedom almost to explore these wonderful sort of frames. More so than like a traditional story.
Yeah.
It was just the frames in there. Each one was like a painting to me.
Really?
Yeah.
Man, I think we're talking about different videos.
I don't know. Maybe the video's crap, but I was just so obsessed with all the frames that you chose.
I totally appreciate that. That's awesome. Well.
So you know, you have a situation where you forgot to press record or forgot a battery or something that's like,
Yeah. Okay. So I've already spoken at length about imposter syndrome with working with Nicky Caro. And basically just, you don't want to fuck up in front of someone that's like at that level. So I was hyper fucking aware of everything I was doing in prep, right? And so we go to PEI to shoot for these 3 days. And me and Nikki are just like, you know what? Yeah, call's like 7 a.m. the first day. Let's just meet you and the camera, go out at like 5 and like shoot bugs crawling on like blades of grass and the sun coming up. I talk to my AC and he's just down to do it. And of course, production's like, you know, we can't afford to pay overtime. I'm like, don't worry, it's fine. I'll fucking buy him a bottle of whiskey. We'll figure it out, you know? And so he's down and like, you know, we go to the camera truck and it's fucking pitch black and we grab everything we need. And like, we're going out to like the marshes and like PEI. And I notice because I'm holding the camera, I don't see a cable between like the eyepiece and the thing. And I'm just like, hey, Jeff, do we have that cable? He's like, yeah, it's in my ditty bag. Don't worry about it. And so we get out to the marshes and like hump the fucking camera like 5 minutes towards like the ocean where we're looking back over like this beautiful marshland and like the sun's like just starting to come up. And I'm like, we got the shot set up and I'm just like, oh, we don't have this fucking cable and we can't frame anything because like we can't hook the EVF up to the camera. And so our base camp is like a 10-minute drive away and we're in PEI, so we don't really have like the best kind of production support. And so we call a PA to bring the cable, but he doesn't know what he's looking for. So he drives and brings the wrong one, goes back and drives back again to brings the wrong one again. And I was just looking over at Nikki and I just see like just her face. She's so tense and just trying not to like fucking explode at anyone. And then the PA gets the right cable, but literally we're shooting at the bottom of a road. Only one way to get to set. And he went the wrong direction and then drove 15 minutes in the wrong direction. So like at this point, like the sun's up. I'm so flabbergasted. I'm just like, I feel like such a fucking hack. Cause I literally noticed it as we were 10 feet from the camera truck. I was like, no, let's just stop and get it now. And it was just like, oh God, it was just so fucking embarrassing. And so I turned to Nikki and with all the fucking strength I can muster, I'm just like, I'm sorry this happened. I promise you this will never, ever happen again on this set. And she just turned to me and because she's a fucking classy person, she just said, okay. And that was it. There was no, you need to do this better. It was just that. That was it. And I was having a fucking panic attack, man. It was so awful.
Did you get something?
Oh, yeah. We were like, the sun came up and then we started shooting. It looked like shit. It was just like, yeah. Anyway, so yeah. So there's that amongst a million other stories of being a complete fuck up. But we'll save those for the next one.
Got it. Great. Fuck, I want to keep going, but we can't because we got to move on to the next thing. Like, you're going to be in here again, dude.
What time is it? Oh, shit. Yeah. What time does that thing? It starts at 2?
Yeah.
Fucking drunk.
But where can people find your work?
BobbyShore.com.
BobbyShore.com. Yeah,
powered by Squarespace.
Powered by Squarespace. Not Wix?
No, fuck Wix, man. I hate Wix. It's awful.
Okay. Bobby, thank you so much.
No, thank you. This was awesome. This was great.
I would love to do this again. I want to keep going for another.
Good luck in editing this because I feel like it's going to be a clusterfuck.
I'm just going to put it. It's actually live streaming right now.
Oh, is it really great? Live streaming to Facebook.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, of course. Thank you, Marty. Thank you, Justin.
Thank you.